Hey folks, before we begin, just a quick reminder that on November 10th through the 13th of this year, Jim and I will be doing a live event in Walt Disney World. Friday, we'll be doing an informal meetup at Rick's Lounge at Coronado Springs. Saturday, we'll be doing a Pandora walkabout and an Illuminations dessert party. Sunday, we'll be recording a show and doing some other stuff around the parks. Get all the details that you need to come visit with us at storybookdestinations.com/DisneyDish. And now on with the show. Welcome back to another edition of the Disney Dish podcast with Jim Hill. It's me, Lynn Testa, and today it's the episode you've been waiting for, lo these many years, listeners. It's the review of Pandora, the World of Avatar, which is opening soon at Disney's Animal Kingdom. In order to do this review, we need to bring in the man who inspired the Na'vi people in James Cameron's imagination. That's one Mr. Jim Hill. Jim, how's it going?
Well, that was only because I held my breath for that long, Len.
He turned blue.
That's right. It's like, hey, I could go with that. I mean, a lot taller and less fat, but yeah, that's a look I could go for.
All right, Jim, so let's begin. You flew down on Thursday, May 11th?
Yeah, like that. And was in there during the day on the 12th. The one thing, I did not get to see it at night because of some problems with the plane flight down. I didn't get in there. Did you get to do the nighttime stuff? Or?
No, actually, I didn't. My preview was Saturday, 12 to 2. But I think we've seen enough to know a little bit about how it's going to look at night. Curiously, the images that they've been showing from night are not of the entire land. And from what I've heard, some of the visual effects aren't yet working. Oh. That's why there haven't been many nighttime previews.
Okay.
So some bioluminous effects weren't working last night, but people were saying the sidewalk effects, the walking path effects were working. But let's begin, Jim. Let's talk about walking in. You walk past what was the entrance to Camp Minnie Mickey. Again, this project started in what, like 2010, right?
Well, they broke ground, I want to say, in 2013.
It's been a long time. It's the area formerly occupied by Camp Minnie Mickey. You walk past now the new Tiffin's restaurant, the new Nomad Lounge. We came to a door where they checked our magic bands. We walked past it, and immediately you're on the pathway. And there are a couple of interesting things that you notice right off the bat that are different from Camp Minnie Mickey. Mm-hmm. For me, it was the moss growing on the iron bridge that crosses the river into the land of Pandora. This was sort of like a spray-on plastic. It's plastic or it's concrete. It's very hard. It looks for all the world like real moss. And I think this is your first indication that there's more detail than you expected going into Pandora.
Oh, definitely. And the bridge there, the rusted moss-covered bridge, that's supposed to represent, you step out of Disney's Animal Kingdom and you're now crossing the equivalent of 4.4 light years to get to the moon of Pandora. No matter what they do with these movies, this all takes place 30 years after that timeline wraps up. Everything that man has built, it's now being subsumed by the jungle.
You see a little bit of this theme over in Asia, but this is, I think, more explicitly done.
Everywhere you go, there are these little stories, just seeing that sort of moss and seeing how it's feeding the bridge, but you walk through the pathways and see the old mess hall that now has the thatch roofing and all that thing extended. This is how the Na'vi have taken what was left behind and turned it into things that they can use, or that people who are now traveling through the Alpha Centauri excursions can take advantage of. And it really is all these little stories that you have to put together yourself. What was your take on that, Len?
My overall impression of the land is positive. The thing that I was most impressed with was how Disney seems to have engineered a better nature than nature. What Disney seems to have done here is built a more colorful, more detailed version of nature. Anyone who's driven through Kansas knows that there are parts of nature that are simply boring, right? I mean, it's not called flyover country for no reason, right? The thing that I found most impressive about Pandora, setting aside the rides and the story, was the fact that every single view from every angle I could check was beautiful, with interesting details everywhere. There is no barren landscape in Pandora. And I think that was the best part of the entire thing. The whole area is just pretty to look at, no matter where you are. Not only pretty, but if you notice how they stacked the views, there's something in your immediate foreground all the time. There's something in your middle distance all the time. And there's something really interesting in the far distance all the time as well. It's like somebody walked through and said, if this was an animated film and we were doing a multi-plane camera, what would be in each plane of our view as we were walking through this land? And then they went and built it in three dimensions. I think that for me is my favorite part of Avatar, how it's a better nature than nature. I was going to say, if Mother Nature created Kansas, then Mother Rhodey created Pandora, you know?
Okay, well, no, I can definitely buy into the better nature than nature. This was the challenge of putting this into Animal Kingdom. Let's face it, the whole conceit of this park is the intrinsic value of nature. And so the bulk of James Cameron's Avatar was done CG. Even they were creating this artificial world, but they were doing it on a server. They were creating, frames of film. It's quite another thing to do this for real and to have it stand up. And as you said, be able to whip your head around 360 degrees and it's like, it all works. It all still holds together. There's no such thing as the bad view, the place where it collapses.
I was particularly impressed as we walked through both queues for Navi River Journey and for Flight of Passage. And I particularly looked for bad views there. And the way I did it was I walked backward through the queue. I mean, obviously, when you're walking through things, Disney's focusing your eyes forward. But I walked both from the side and then backward to see what it looked like. It was beautiful everywhere. Every single shot was framed by something. I walked all around the floating mountains, which we should talk about next. I did not see anything ugly on it. But let's talk about the floating mountains. They are much better executed than I had any right to hope Disney was going to do.
No, you're right. But the thing for me, like, for example, the waterfalls.
Yes!
Somewhere in that great tangle of vines and all that, there have to be water pipes. That's all hidden there in plain sight. By the way, I checked with the Imagineers who were driving the project, and I guess they broke ground in 2014, and it was only in 2015 or thereabouts they had to step away from the conceit of movement in the mountain. They were hoping at one point that they'd be able to create sort of a hinge effect, and so that they would, in fact, have limited movement. But in the end, it was just sort of like, it was a bridge too far. It was the one thing they couldn't do.
Yeah. The maintenance on the hinges would have been, I mean, you think the Yeti's broken and, it doesn't get maintained? Try hinges in mountains.
So anyway, what they did to sell that story point, this particular set of floating mountains that have come into the Valley of Mora, at the point where you see the waterfall, pay attention to the lowest, most point of the mountain. This particular set of mountains floated into the Valley of Mora and accidentally struck a rock outcropping. That's why actually the mountains are slightly canted upward rather than the floating level. When you look at the waterfalls, you can see where there's a stain just off at like a 45 degree angle from the waterfall. That's the way the waterfall used to come down when the mountains were actually floating. But once they struck and they were knocked slightly off kilter, the waterfalls took a new path, but you can still see the old path. I mean, that's the little detail upon little detail upon little detail that's supposed to tell you that story.
I love the idea that some Imagineer had to figure out the orbital dynamics of floating mountains to figure out where the smudge went.
The meetings upon meetings they had just to sign off on each individual layer of design. And neither you and I have experienced the nighttime version of this.
No.
I spoke with Matt Bailey, the show producer in Pandora, and he said, this is a land you have to come back to and see at night because it's completely different. It goes from the majestic, beautiful grandeur of the floating mountains to this romantic place that's alive with light. It, as he put it, this is the crown jewel of the nighttime reawakening of Animal Kingdom.
Yeah, I think that could be true. I definitely need to go back to see it at night. My sense is it probably won't be open at night until after Memorial Day. Mm. Let's talk a little bit more about the water, though. One of the things that I love about Pandora is that there's water everywhere, and it does two things. It provides a background ambient noise that sort of walks with you as you go throughout the land. But the other thing that I really liked is the ambient sounds that they're piping in, the animal sounds.
Oh, God, yeah.
And that is incredibly detailed as well. You want to talk about that?
That's ridiculously complex. It's not just a sound profile. The way this is set up, you'll hear an animal moving through the brush that will then make a call. And then across the way, you'll hear either an animal from the same species call in response, or you'll hear different species who are warning the other animals in the area. It's like, oh, crap, the big thing is coming.
Predator!
Yeah. Yeah, that level of storytelling, which reinforces that you're in a real place.
Yeah.
You lived for a long time in the Carolinas, so you, you remember your battles with raccoons and hedgehogs or groundhogs. You know, that wall of sound is an everyday thing that you just accept when you live in this sort of environment.
One of the things that I noticed, though, is that the noises themselves seem to change with the time of day. Like, there seems to be a morning cadence, an afternoon cadence, and I'm assuming there's going to be an evening cadence where, you know, things are waking up. Then during the middle part of the day, it's a little bit more sedate in terms of the noise. And then I guess it picks up again at night.
I'm told that the particularly impressive time will be sunset headed into twilight, headed into night. That there's a sophisticated sound profile for that period. Whereas everything that was out and in this area at daytime is headed to bed, and other things begin to wake up, and the nighttime insects and the jungle coming alive at night. It might be worth it just to hang out in Pandora and listen to the symphony of sound. Also, the bioluminescent jungle wakes up.
What did you think about the walking paths through Pandora? They're not sort of the hub-and-spoke architecture of Main Street USA. These are definitely more meandering pathways, right?
Yeah, but at the same time, you did the same thing I did. You came in the bridge over Tiffin's. You left over the bridge through Tiffin's, right?
Yeah, the walkway to Africa wasn't open yet, although there, you could see cast members walking to it, and there's definitely a bridge there as well.
Yeah, for all of the feel of this is actually the way paths would go to the terrain, there isn't a sense of, well, where does this path take me, and, and now I'm lost. I mean, there's a simplicity and a clarity to it, the way you navigate.
Is there a guideline for it? I mean, they tell you, like, specifically always head left or something like that?
No, not yet. That's the challenge from your side of the fence. You're going to have to, from a touring plan's point of view, how are you going to tell people to travel through this land? Because half the charm of it is that, where does that go?
You know? To me, it reminded me of the Oasis, where the entry point of the Animal Kingdom, where there are, as the song says, two paths you can go by, but you end up on Discovery Island either way. The way I counted it in Pandora, if you wanted to get to Navi River Journey, or you wanted to get to Flight of Passage, there were at least three different paths you could take to get to those, not counting all the little cutouts which where the paths joined up, but at least three distinct routes to get in. And I thought that was pretty good. And the thing I liked about the routes, one of them was sort of the fairly wide, although curvy path that Disney would, you know, expect to take with a large group or something like that. But others were fairly small. They all had different terrain heights. So some were a little bit more elevated than others. A couple of them went over streams. And I liked the variety there. Some of the bridges were flat. Some of the bridges appeared arched. Some of them appeared definitely much more man-made than others, or Navi-made.
When you come out of the Navi River excursion, I love that bridge just for the wear and tear.
Yeah. There's a metal base on the bridge, and you can tell at one point it was supposed to be metal that was made into crosshatch X's, right, into X shapes. But there's now dirt and, of course, moss growing up in the holes around the metal where the metal touched the dirt. And so dirt had started to come over it. And you can't see the metal in other places, but there are other places where you can actually see the metal exposed. And it definitely looks like it's been worn by years and years of footsteps. Yep. So they've aged that as well. You mentioned Navi River Journey. Is that the first ride you went on?
Yeah. I don't know what you experienced with Flight of Passage, but they seem to be having some operational hiccups.
Oh, we'll talk about that, Jim. Okay. Let's talk about Navi River Journey. Okay. It's with if you follow the path in and you stay basically to your left, you will end up at Navi River Journey. For the AP preview, they told us we could ride it as many times as we wanted, and we weren't going to need FastPass for it. Whereas for Flight of Passage, they gave us a 15-minute return window printed on a FastPass pass, the old style ones, and said, this is the time at which you will ride it. So the first thing we rode was Navi River Journey. What would you describe the queue like? It's this large straw hut-like structure that holds the line, right?
Let's actually back up to, what did you think about the non-marquee marquee?
The fact that there's not much signage that tells you this is the ride.
Yeah.
I liked it. The thing they may have problems with is people finding it. I can definitely see Disney having to put cast members out or signs out saying Navi River Journey, mm-hmm. you know, ahead. It's a subtle land. If they had a neon sign or something like that, Navi here with a big arrow, that would not be the right sense of place. It definitely was hard to find the entrance to it. Although once you did, then you just go back to it. I liked it. It was subtle, and I think a lot of the land is subtle. I think it fit in perfectly. Whether it works operationally, it's like, this painting is lovely, but I wouldn't want to live in it.
Yeah.
We'll see how it runs.
I love going through the queue and seeing all of the Navi folk art, the weaving, tornado shaped supports and that sort of thing. When you finally get into this thing, so two boats launch at the same time, each boat holds four people, so it's groups of eight being pulsed through this 4 minute long attraction.
Yeah, I think it's 5 minutes including load time, but the design time, as they say, the time at which you're actually looking at stuff, is four minutes, which is relatively short for a boat ride. What do you think about the boat size? 2x2. This is definitely not a Pirates of the Caribbean boat.
No, not at all. Not at all. And I think that you're here in Pandora and we want you to feel things. And so, when you're, how many people are in a bateau for Pirates of the Caribbean? There was six rows of four, so 24 people at a time.
Yeah, most Americans can fit three in there, but still 18 to 24, let's say. Yeah.
And so, on Pirates, you're not expected to feel anything. You know, here, that was the notion, that you're supposed to be surrounded by this bioluminescent forest and see all these creatures in the riverbank. And I know that some people sort of like, oh, it's projections for the animals and that sort of thing. But I loved actually the animation on the animals, like the viper wolves, I believe they are. I love that they actually behave like animals, whether grabbing their young and leaving the scene or sort of growling at people in the boats that are passing by. I mean, it was very understated, but at the same time, the sense that you are in a real place observing. And in fact, honestly, one of my favorite details is that part where you're going under the giant leaves and you're watching them bow down.
Right.
As the creatures are jumping from leaf to leaf.
And by the way, as I'm going through Pandora, I think in the back of both of our minds, we're comparing this to Diagon Alley, right? Let's just be blunt about this.
Yep.
One of the things that I thought Navi River Journey did better than Gringotts, and I'm not saying it's the same ride as Gringotts, but one of the improvements that I see is there are screens in both rides. One of the interesting things that Disney seems to have done with the screens is, although there's a screen projection on which you can see the wolves and the other things, there are other things behind that screen. Mm-hmm. Again, like this idea of a multi-plane camera where you've got something in the foreground, the medium distance, and then the far distance. And the fact that you can see things moving at a separate pace in the distance, in addition to the thing that you're supposed to be watching in the screen in the middle distance, the fact that all of those things are happening at their own paces, to me, adds more depth to the scene than I got out of Gringotts.
Well, it's funny.
I'm not saying Navi's a better ride than Gringotts. I'm saying that particular element where both rides have screens, Disney seems to have done screens better.
Oh, no, I got to give that to you. I think one of my favorite moments out of the attraction is the first time you see sort of a group of Navi people moving through the jungle, they're at a distance and you're looking through foliage at them. And in fact, it takes you a moment or two to realize, what am I looking at? Like, oh, cool. But in the foreground, there's like this rotted tree trunk that has fallen over the space. And you can actually see little glow in the dark worms and centipedes that are making their way around the log or that sort of thing. I mean, it's just,
that is one of my favorite effects in the entire ride. Did you see how they did it?
No, how?
Video projection.
Oh,
yes. Okay. Well, we just talked about it happily ever after. Disney seems to have gone all in on this because and I actually had to ride it twice. And it was only after the second time that I realized it was video projection. The second time through, I focused specifically on that as soon as you could see it. That's another great use of that technology to add three-dimensional effects
to a
set like that.
I agree.
Oh, yeah. That was really good. So you mentioned the fact that as you're floating, you go underneath these large, I hate to use the word bioluminescent, but let's go with it. Bioluminescent plant leaves that are humongous, 5 feet long and 3 feet wide. And they're translucent, so you can see bugs and other animals hopping on them. And as they hop on them, the leaves actually bounce up and down. It seems to be, the amount of movement seems to be adjusted based on the size of the animal.
That's it, exactly. Yeah.
That's walking on the leaf. That's nice.
Mm-hmm. But the weird thing is that every so often I'd get pulled out by, for example, the giant pink dangly things that don't move.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to circle back on the Navi River to see if the other elements of the jungle will come alive once they have time to get them all installed. If what you're hearing true about the nighttime lighting profile being not are completely up and running at this point, I mean, again, they've got a hard opening on, what is it, May 26th, that they still have
less than 2 weeks.
Yeah. So it's just sort of, you know, lots of folks working at night with flashlights.
For me, the one effect that didn't work on Navi River, we still have to talk about the animatronic, but the one effect that didn't work for me is there are these dinner plate-sized spiral glowing things that move up and down in the trees, and they're very bright to the point where your eye will focus on those first as you round the turns of the Navi River. And the thing that bothers me about it is, I mean, just from an evolutionary point, no animal has ever evolved a helicopter-like method of flight, right? It's like, you know, I studied evolution in graduate school. You know, no animal has ever evolved the wheel and axle as a method of movement. I mean, for the creators of Pandora to say, oh yeah, this thing is going to be essentially be like an Archimedes screw through the air, and that's how we're going to fly. Come on. It's not realistic. The other thing is it moves too slow for there to be any possible way that enough air could be going through it. And for me, the fact that it looks like it doesn't work and it's so bright reminded me a lot of Under the Sea, Journey of the Little Mermaid, like those types of very simple effects. And that brought me out a little bit from it. But overall, I thought the atmosphere of the effects is good. We did point out, Jim, that there's not an obvious plot.
No.
In River Journey. And I think this is different than the rides in the Magic Kingdom or the rides in Epcot or even the studios where, you know, Disney has traditionally given you an explicit narrative. If not explicit, an easily understood implicit narrative. Like in Pirates of the Caribbean, it's fairly obvious that once you get into the main scene, you're watching pirates attack a town and you're seeing it evolve both through time and space, right? If you look at Spaceship Earth, the history of communications unfolds along a timeline. There isn't the obvious plot in Navi River Journey, although from what I understand, having ridden it a few times, it's the idea that you're going through the forest and watching all of these creatures go to a sacred spot for some sort of ceremony. That seems to be the plot, right?
Yeah, but you said that the W word, I know you said wizarding. Part of the problem here is, you know, you're going to see the Shaman of Song. We've both seen Avatar, and I didn't see that character in that movie, did I?
That's why I asked you whether this theme park land is part of the canon.
Well, according to John Landau, the producer of the film,
who you met on your press thing, right? By the way, John's here. You
know, some of the stuff that's been introduced in this land will show up in the movies, and I can't help but think that at some point, if the Shaman of Song is introduced as a character in the films and drives a certain story point or you know, how significant that character is, that'll become a big deal. Right now, I'm looking at it and thinking, that's the most amazing AA figure I've ever seen.
It is, and that's exactly what I got out of it, too. It's the most amazing animatronic. By the way, one of the cast members told us after the ride that the animatronic's eyes are designed to lock on you in each row of the boat as you pass through it.
That moment of intimacy with the character.
That was a little... I wasn't expecting it the first time, even though I knew to expect it. It was very, very, very interesting. The other thing I liked about the animatronic, other than the fact that it is easily the most fluid and lifelike of the animatronics, the singer that they chose to voice the Shaman is not a professional singer by any means. This is like the tonal quality of the music is like you or I singing these songs, right, Jim? Right? And I like that. I appreciate it.
They didn't go out
and hire a professional singer for it.
That's right.
And I liked it. I liked it quite a bit. What's your overall impression of the ride? The A is the big end of it, right?
I know pleasant is a really mild word.
Yeah, you're damning with faint praise there, but yeah.
Yes, it's immersive. Yes, you're surrounded by this amazing level of detail. Yes, it's rewritable, but it's pleasant. From a FedEx point of view, yes, it's groundbreaking. From a storytelling point of view, not so much. I mean, it really is very small worldly, but you don't have your catchy song or your stylized designer, that sort of thing. I mean, it just It is incredibly well done for what it is, but it's a 4-minute long boat ride to meet a character that you haven't met before. I give it high marks for execution. You know, I love the detail and the design of it, but I just never felt like I was emotionally engaged.
I felt like I was in a very detailed live environment, you know, in terms of like bonding with the characters or things like that. I mean, not really. But this was my checklist as I was going through it. Does it fit in the theme of the land? Obviously it does. Does it advance the story incrementally? It's not like going back to Pirates. The fact that Pirates is an Adventureland adds to the story of Adventureland. I don't see the same sort of additive quality of the story of the Navi River Journey. It's more like, in terms of adding to the story, it's more like Grand Vista Tour does to the Mexico Pavilion, which I think stands on its own. The detail that they put into it, and especially the multi-layered effects that they have in it, make it better than other aspects of similar rides, right? They make it similar rides. It's better than Grand Fiesta, obviously, because it's got more technology. The AA figure alone is probably worth it. You know, is it better than Small World? And this is actually how I'm ranking this. Is it better than Small World? I'm not sure. Is it better than Pirates? I don't think it's better than Pirates. Mm-hmm. Pirates has a story with elaborate sets. So for me, it's somewhere between, you know, Grand Fiesta, which is definitely better than, but not as good as Pirates. For me, that's somewhere in Small World territory.
Okay. No,
I like what you said about Small World having a distinct visual style. Mm-hmm. I mean, Mary Blair created that. And you can look at things, other things that Disney does in the same style and say, oh, they're, you know, this is an homage to Mary Blair, or this is, you know, this is in the style of Small World. Mm-hmm. I don't know that you'll be able to do the same thing for Navi River Journey. So for me, it's going to fall somewhere in there. I'm thinking 3.5, 4 stars out of 5, you know, mm-hmm. depending on the mood that I'm in and what I ate the night before. Would I go on it again? Yes. I would go on it again for the visual elements. And look at the, yeah. It's rewritable. I'll give it that.
No, I that's it exactly. I'm sure every time I ride it, I will see something different. I mean, those strange little goat creatures that come down by the river, I loved.
Yeah.
I loved how once they exited, the plants opened again. I mean, it was something.
Yeah, that was a nice touch, yeah.
See, that's the thing. There's enough in it that even grading it, you know, 3.5 to 4, it's still something, hey, we're going into Pandora. Oh, we can do the river ride.
I go on Pirates of the Caribbean every time I'm in the Magic Kingdom. I go on Grand Fiesta Tour every time I'm in the Mexico Pavilion. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't go on Small World that often because the song will stick with me. But it's going to be one of those things where if I'm there, you know, and mm-hmm. the line's not an hour long, I'll go on it. I would wait, you know, 20 minutes for the ride. The other couple of things I really liked about the ride, mm-hmm. I like the fact that it's two-person, two-row boats. And the reason for that is it fits in the story of the Navi creating these things out of woven reeds, right? The Navi don't have fiberglass, right? There's no Chriscraft in Pandora, so they don't have the boat styles of Pirates of the Caribbean. And I really appreciate that. The fact that they got that level of detail right only adds to it. In the queuing area, when you get to the main area, it's sort of like a giant domed hut. Mm-hmm. And there are a couple of things I like about it. Again, it shows the weaving skills of the Navi. But did you notice that they had fans built so that you're being constantly cooled as you walk through the land? And it was 94 degrees when I was walking this, and overcast. Mm-hmm. Thank you, whoever planned that. And the Disney seems to have clearly understood that there's going to be some air movement needed to keep these people comfortable in line. I really liked it. There are a couple of places in Pandora, and we'll talk about the next one, where you definitely feel like between the background music and the woven reed emphasis on building materials, you could be in the Animal Kingdom Lodge.
That's it exactly. I love that they found that way to create sort of a visual consistency between the various components of this theme park and its associated resorts and that sort of thing.
Yeah. So what did you do after you did Navi River Journey?
Well, no. Before we go, we have to tell the story about the shaman, the Yeti story.
Oh, that's right. So one of the things that I'm writing for the unofficial guide is, and I'll probably go with 3.5 stars for the review. And literally in the review I wrote this, I said, it's 3.5 stars for now. If they can keep this animatronic running for a year, I'll add another half a star to it. Honest to God, it's the review. And the reason for that is that Disney's previously tried, you know, very complicated animatronics, and it's the Yeti over at Expedition Everest. The thing broke, and they were never able to fix it. You and I have talked about it before. They were never able to fix it because the way they built the Yeti, there was no way to maintain it once it was in place. They've learned their lesson here. What's the story, Jim?
Well, they had what they call the Yeti meeting, When they were building Navi River, and as well as, I want to say, the Grizzly River equivalent that was done for Shanghai Disneyland, the one that has the giant crocodile creature. Mm-hmm. What they do now is that if we're building a sophisticated animatronic that's a key feature in an attraction, there has to be a way to maintain it. It cannot be built in such a way that we can't get in to fix it. So, for example, for the crocodile creature at Shanghai Disneyland, there's actually a catwalk built inside of it. If they need to maintain it, they hit a button, the tail lifts up like a garage door, and people can walk up the inside of it and maintain the animatronics and change out the eyeballs, whatever they need to do. With the shaman, Len and I just learned, that AA figure is built in such a way that if it has an operational issue, mm-hmm. it's actually on a retractable pad. It can be pulled off stage into a maintenance bay, and they can make the repair in that show building. They hit the button, and the pad rolls back out into show position, and she can go back to singing and beating on those reeds.
And from what we heard, the meeting was literally, let's have the Yeti meeting.
Yeah.
It's like having a disease named after you. I don't know who Jim Parkinson was, but you know, but we all know his name. It's gonna be it's the Yeti meeting. Yeah.
There we go. All right. It's so like that, anyway, now we transition to Flights of Passage.
All right. The headliner attraction of the land, the big buildup for it. Let's describe the queue. You actually walk up into the lid. So the way that the Pandora rides are built is Flight of Passage sits on top of part of Navi River Journey. And because of that, you actually walk up a switchback on a hill to get to the entrance to the Flight of Passage ride, right?
Yes, you do. At one point, you can look up. You can actually see the arch-like rock structures that were such a signature part of the Avatar film.
So let me say, Jim, that we'll probably talk about this queue for the next 10 minutes because it is the longest line I have ever seen in my entire life. I asked a cast member, and I said, what happens when this line is full? How long is the wait? Do you know how long the wait is?
No.
It's 5 hours. if the line is full, it's if you can see the line from outside, the line is 5 hours long.
Oh, my God.
It winds through this mountain. I think you go through, like, every historical and geologic period within mm-hmm. Pandora. You go into the mountain, and it starts as a cave, and one of the things I love about it is it's not the typical Disney entrance where it's obvious this is the entrance. The openings that you go through aren't perfectly rounded. They look like they're crevices in the rock. As you wind through mm-hmm. the queue, you can tell you're definitely walking through Navi caves that were then appropriated for the human experiments or the human inhabitants of it. So you, as you're walking through the queue, you get this element of, these were caves that were populated by the Navi thousands of years ago, and here's where, you know, the humans have come in and dug tunnels and added their infrastructure and whatnot. And you weave back and forth between these. And again, you're walking up and down at different levels. But the amount of detail in the queue, every single step, mm-hmm. there's something to see. If you're there for 5 hours, you will see a lot.
No doubt. Did you go in through the fast pass side?
I did both. I actually walked the standby line just to see. And they were letting us do it. They were letting us tour the standby line just as an attraction by itself. And I was really impressed with the standby line.
I got as far back in the standby line as the top of the jungle. But what is the deal with the jungle?
About halfway through the queue, mm-hmm. you walk back out into the jungle, but it's nighttime jungle.
How much of a line is in there?
You know, it's hard to say because by that time, mm-hmm. you've already gone through, I think, the cave people, the Navi cave experience where they've got sort of the cave paintings. Mm-hmm. You've gone through a couple of airlocks of the Ace.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Ace. And then you're out in sort of like the back wing of the camp mm-hmm. where you're in the jungle and it's like you're walking outside on a metal walkway that sort of passes through the jungle as a scenic overlook, and then you head back into the building. But it's definitely nighttime jungle, very pretty, very well done. Mm-hmm. And you can start to see different plants there. And there are actually plants in there that you don't see outside or you don't see in Navi River Journey. So again, just another layer of detail. But everywhere you look, mm-hmm. it's not only, you know, here are the things that you're looking at immediately in the line. You look farther down the line and there's something off in the distance, and mm-hmm. it's supposed to be in the distance. You never get close to it, but you can tell it's detailed as well. And then you swing back in and you end up in a laboratory.
And this is, you are now back in the film where they introduce the whole concept of how one connects with an actual avatar. And well, you have to talk about the creepy thing in the tube.
There's a couple of things before you go through it. What are the effects that I like? So it's almost like Mission Space in that you go by like a mission command module thing. And they've got sort of this round area where experiments are going on. There are tubes in which there's flowing water and little bubbly things that move up and down. And as you go through it, there's a video display at the bottom that explains what the experiment is. And if you stand there long enough over a period of 10 minutes, they actually change the narrative of what you're looking at. In one aspect or in one display, the things that are moving the tube are supposed to be an aerodynamic test of what it's like to fly on the back of a Banshee. In another one, it's the movement of the little egg-like things in the tube are supposed to be Banshee egg incubations. So they're just periodically moving them. But the other thing I liked in there is you're walking past these experiments, and there are these black metal blobs in different shapes that move. And imagine a starfish, but made entirely black and slightly metallic looking, moving around a container. But then as it gets to the edges of the container, the arms of the starfish retract into the starfish body so that it becomes a blob. And then as it moves off the corners back, the starfish shape reemerges.
I hate to do this. It's a wonderful, impressive effect.
I'm totally making it at home. I know how they do it.
Well, no, that's it exactly. It's Hobo Joe, all right?
It's Hobo Joe. It's a ferrous metal in a liquid.
No, that's it exactly.
The six people who understand this little kid's drawing thing that we just referenced, it's Hobo Joe.
I mean, I was so happy when somebody explained that to me. It's like, wow, okay, so...
It's a liquid with a ferrous metal suspended in it, and with correctly shaped magnets in the back pulling it along.
There you go.
Great party trick, though. I mean, just really... And they've got different shaped ones. But all of that leads up to... You can tell they're doing experiments, and the experiments go from sort of like the abstract, you know, aerodynamic wind tunnel things to here are some small-scale things we're doing with living creatures. To the big effect, which is this got to be 10-foot long Navi floating in a tube. You know how, like, in Living with the Land, for this is for reference, in Living with the Land, as you're going through the boat ride, you pass the alligator where the alligators used to be, and you see those long tubes where they're farming shrimp. Imagine that, but with a person suspended in it. That's what you're looking at here, a giant blue person with an umbilical cord. What'd you think?
They do such a great job of selling that this is a real thing, whether it's the finger twitch or the jerky movement of someone sleeping or that sort of thing. This isn't an audio animatronic figure sword fighting, all right? The things that one associates with this sort of technology, this is all little subtle movement that sells that this is a living thing.
I thought it was fairly well done. I think it was a little oversold based on the conversations I had heard. It's very realistic. Don't get me wrong. And if I'm standing there for 5 minutes in the line as I walk past it, I would definitely appreciate the subtle touches of it. It was a little anticlimactic for me. After seeing everything else, it was good for what it was. Once you get to that point, though, you're pretty much on the ride, right? They divvy up into groups.
There you go.
And it's almost like Mission Space, where you go into different areas, you stand on little circles. And this is where the pre-show begins. No matter which line you get in, no matter which room you go into, there is a pre-show that explains how they're going to link you to an avatar riding on the Banshee, so it feels like you're riding the Banshee. And they do some interesting effects. I won't spoil this, but they do some interesting effects where they pretend to scan you for, you know, different things like parasites and whatnot. And then there's videos that explain the background of how they were able to do this, and they tell a story about it, and they explain what's going to happen. By the way, did you notice that there's two parts to the pre-show movie? The first part is the same for everyone. The second part is different, depending on which room you're in.
Oh, really? Okay.
So the reason I know this is because the ride broke down on us as soon as we finished the pre-show movie. They had to move us to another room, and the second half of the movie was different.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, so different pre-show experiences too. Again, but I think this is classic Pandora. There are levels of detail here that you're just not going to see until you go back again and again. We eventually get in on the ride, and I think it's 16 people per level, and I think there are three levels in it. So in many ways, it's like Soarin' in that there are three different height levels and multiple people on it. and there's more briefings. I think that actually the pre-show goes on a little long, but I understand why they're doing it. Mm-hmm. It's to keep you occupied and to break up the wait. You're eventually escorted into a room where it looks like, Jim, you're in the Soul Cycle class from hell. You're asked to stand behind this thing that looks like if you had to build a motorcycle replica out of plastic, This is what you would come up with. It's got sort of interesting handlebar shapes. You can tell there's a seat, there's a display in front, and they're very specific about the way in which you should enter this contraption because it's surrounded by a plastic shroud. And they what they tell you is to stand to the left of it and throw your leg over like you're riding a bicycle. Did anybody in your group have trouble with this?
No, though I've been following this ride system was the one that, you know, Disney paid very close attention to all the weight-related, size-related issues that Universal had with the flying benches for Forbidden Journey. And this being sort of a new iteration of the soaring technology, but again, they wanted to give you that ride-on experience.
Yeah.
The one issue I guess they're having is that people with calves that are particularly large, whether, you know, you're a weight, again, and I guess it's a number of people who lift weights or that sort of thing that are having an issue that aren't being allowed to ride because they have really muscular, large calves. But that's the thing, you have to scoot.
You have to scoot all the way forward.
Yeah.
All the way, yeah.
You know.
It was almost like getting your shoes measured as your kid. Remember they would tell you to, like, push your feet all the way
there
forward
we go.
Or back? Okay. It was exactly like this. They would tell you specifically, if there was an inch of room between the front of this, the front of your shroud, plastic shroud, and your foot, they would tell you to move it all the way forward. Once everyone is seated, you've got your hands on these sort of U-shaped, actually, they're like double V-shaped handlebars. There's a little display in front of you. You're looking down at that, and, you're wearing goggles, too, 3D goggles. Once everyone is seated and everyone is set, the restraint system gets activated. At that point, you start to feel like a cow that's about to be inseminated. There is no other explanation for it than this. Something comes up and holds your back in place.
Yeah, a little.
Something comes up and holds your leg in place. And it's to say that it's a snug fit is, I think, an understatement. The woman next to me said, at this point in this experience, someone should have bought me a drink. That was her line, and I loved it.
No, I have to ask, once you were in the restraints, how soon after that did the ride begin?
For us, it was at least a minute that we were restrained and nothing at all happened. And I think there was actually some technical difficulty here.
Yeah.
The fact is that three levels of rows of 16 have to all be synchronized. If one person needs a little bit more time to adjust themselves in the restraint, all 48 people sit being restrained until that one person is ready to fly. And I think that's causing some of the problem. And I understand why they have to do it, but I think operationally, they have to get that time down.
Oh, God, yeah.
Otherwise, this hourly capacity of this ride is going to be terrible. By the way, did you hear what the hourly capacity limit is, the high?
How?
I heard it's 1,400 people an hour, but the way that they're running it through, I calculated they couldn't get more than 1,000.
Wow.
And 1,000 people an hour for something like that is less than Dumbo right now. Uh-huh. So they definitely have to get the restraint system better. And they have to get the timing of it better. So the things have to be a little snappier. I wouldn't be surprised if they actually cut down the pre-show a little bit. Because to me, the pre-show went on for about a minute too long.
Well, I think, honestly, the pre-show is there vamping. In fact, did you get the, hang on, I'm having an issue, and he steps out of the lab moment?
That's common in both.
Okay.
But then the second part of it was, here's a history of the lab. And it was the Sigourney Weaver character history. And then in the other one, it was talking about the cultural significance of riding the Banshee.
Yeah, okay. The whole notion of when you're in the restraint and you're hanging there, and it could have been a minute, it could have been four, I'm not sure. My case, that amount of lag time, all of the wonderful prep that you've done in advance, all of the wonderful storytelling falls apart because you're just sitting there in that restraint waiting for this experience to begin.
It's true. It sort of breaks the narrative.
Yeah.
We should say, as you're seeing this harness, you're looking at a metal wall.
Yep.
A metal wall with basically horizontal panels.
Yeah.
The lights dim. I think there's a flash of light. Everything goes dark.
And you have a great Starfield effect that from the moment that you're supposedly syncing with your avatar.
Right. Yeah. It's sort of like going through hyperspace or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're flying.
What did you think?
So I'd just been on Soarin' the day before.
Okay.
I think, this, again, damning with faint praise, it's pleasant. you understand why they do the ride vehicle. So it's, imagine instead of hang gliding over California, you're riding a motorcycle in the air around California. It's like that. You definitely see the similar style in the film with Soren, where you're flying above things and below things, and you know there's the animals are doing things below you as you fly over the landscape, and there's twists and turns. I did like the fact that you could, as you were supposedly riding this banshee, you could feel it breathing.
Mm-hmm.
So there are air bladders down by your legs, which expand and contract like the banshee is breathing. The thing I didn't feel was, I didn't feel the banshee breathing harder as it exerted itself
mm-hmm.
throughout the ride. What'd you think of the ride experience itself?
Again, pleasant is the word. And you know what I think the problem is? I don't know where I am. You know, there's only been the one Avatar film. And yes, we are now flying over a jungle. But what jungle is this? And now I'm flying down by the shore. But what shore is this? And yes,
yeah, why? Yeah, what's the significance of this particular thing that I'm looking at? Yeah,
you know,
I agree.
I mean, and when you're on Soaring, it's like, oh, that's the Taj Mahal. Oh, that's the Eiffel Tower. These are places I know, and I have emotions connected with them. In Flight of Passage, the flying itself is wonderful. I just don't know what I'm looking at and what is significant about it.
Yeah.
I bet you that, again, when Pandora 2, 3, 4, and the prequel comes out, and suddenly, oh my God, I'm by the Sacred Sea, or, oh, look, it's that herd full of those really dangerous animals that they fought in the third film. I mean, when I right. know what I'm looking at, this will mean something. But right now, it's just sort of like, that's a thing, and I'm flying over the thing, and I'm under the thing. The one moment that registers is the attack by the giant flying thing, because it's like, okay, that's the thing that Jake tamed in the first movie, and even the Na'vi people were impressed by that, because, you know, this is the wild creature that no one's ever tamed before, and here is one.
That's actually the only one thing that I recognized. The thing that you just mentioned, the fact that we don't know why we care about these things, that's the criticism, not only with the land, but with the film.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the day,
yeah.
We all appreciate the craft and the technical nature that was the Pandora film. Mm-hmm. Nobody gives a damn about the plot. No one cares about the movie itself, you know, in terms of the characters or the meaning of it. And I think that's the one thing that's lacking in both rides. The fact that we don't really have an emotional connection to either the story or the characters that go about it.
Mm-hmm.
It's all great to look at. It's fine. But there's no real emotional connection with any of it. And that's not Disney's fault. No, it's not.
It's the source material. And they have brought every tool. Everything's brilliantly executed, hyper detailed. They have tried to make you feel, and they get you really close. I felt more walking around just the land than I did on either of the two rides.
Jim, we had the exact same experience. Let me tell you, maybe you were my avatar for this, because I thought exactly the same thing. Do I like the rides?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Do I like the land? I love the land.
There we go.
The other thing I would say about the film, and mm-hmm. other than the fact that there's no real emotional connection with anything, you could feel the pacing and mm-hmm. the beats that they had to hit in it mm-hmm. were exactly the same as Soren. So are you familiar with, I forget the name of the book, but apparently a book came out a couple of years ago that was essentially saying, here's how to write a movie. At 30 seconds in, your scene has to show this. 2.5 minutes in, your plot should do this. 5 minutes in, your plot should do this, right? And the funny thing is that if you go back and look at a lot of the hit films that have been made since that book came out, they follow the same plot. And I think I felt the same way about the Pandora ride. Mm-hmm. You know, you could feel how there's an act one, an act two, and an act three, and you know how it's going to end. You know, in a beautiful sunset on the beach, and it's basically the same sort of beats as you get on Soarin', mm-hmm. where you start off in the morning somewhere, you go through the afternoon, you end up at night at the Eiffel Tower. Same sort of formula there, although it's, you know, completely different scenes. Again, technically, a very good ride. Would I ride it again? Yeah, probably. People around me loved it, by the way.
I've had people talk about how, you know, they've used the words like transformative, or that they came off it in tears, and I will tell you, whenever I ride Soaring, I well up with emotion. That ride for me, that's the attraction equivalent of a poem.
Yeah. Even knowing that it's all like CGI.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I will say this. I rode Soaring, this last time I rode it was the first time I rode it in the middle set of seats. And it's a vastly better experience
mm-hmm.
in the middle set of seats. So our listeners,
it's interesting you say that, because I had seat 16 on this, and I'll have to go back and try it again, hopefully to get a seat that's directly in the middle and see if that'll close the deal.
Laurel was also in seat 16, and she said that at one point she had turned her head just to sort of look around the scene, and she managed to see all 16 people in all three rows, and it sort of brought her out of the experience.
Okay.
I was in 15, and I didn't turn my head that much, so I never really got the effect that I was out of it. The one thing that I did get on it was that my glasses were kind of smudged, so everything was a little bit blurry for me, but you know, they can fix that. So okay. Scale of 1 to 5, how many stars for this ride?
I gotta say, it's like a 3.5, a 4? Where would you put it?
4.
Yeah.
It's a good ride. I think we should do the food in a separate show, so let's do that. But let's sum up the land itself, excluding the food. What's your overall impression of it?
The point that sold the land for me, you come to that overlook that looks out over the park and, you know, the sort of the first real glimpse of the floating mountains. It's when you made that walk to the left after going around the weird smoking leaky plant. But but then if you turn around, there is this tree that clearly has been torn apart by something that's looking for grubs. And I sit there for a moment and realize, that's sculpted. Somebody actually created a rotted tree that had been attacked by something looking for food. And it looks like it's been there forever. And it looks like I could go out in the woods in my backyard and find something that looks just like it. Only this is an otherworldly tree. It has that look to it. Ultimately makes you buy into, I have somehow gotten off the moon of Pandora. I don't know how I got here, you know, crossing that bridge, but I'm here.
So I'm going to ask the question that's on everyone's mind. Better than Diagon Alley or no?
I have to say no. With the understanding that the reason that Diagon Alley and Hogsmeade are better is that these are based on 8 movies, 7 books. You know more of the Wizarding World. I keep telling folks, though, that I honestly think that 3 and 4 films into these prequels or that sort of thing, this land is going to resonate. People are going to make such a stronger connection when they're that much more familiar with the world. Disney has done brilliant execution on not enough source material. It's not a strong enough IP to have built an entire land on. But that said, I cannot wait from the lessons they learned from building Avatar. If they do the same thing with Star Wars Land, I will pitch a pup tent outside of this. But, you know, I'll sit in line. You know,
we'll get in line.
Yeah.
So I actually liked it better than Diagon Alley.
Did you really? Okay.
I did. And here's why. So I'm not a huge Harry Potter fan. I've seen part of one movie, but I love Diagon Alley. I spent 6 hours in there and was just enthralled by it.
Mm-hmm.
But for people like me who don't really have an emotional connection to either film,
mm-hmm.
whether you like one land above the other is going to come down to whether you like the city or nature. And for me, I like nature a little bit more in this context.
Okay.
Waterfalls for me resonate more than the city does. And the fact that it's bigger and they've got floating mountains and that that extra level of detail, the layers upon layers for me.
Mm-hmm.
Is it a huge margin of victory for Pandora? No, it's not. I would gladly spend time in either. I do agree with you, though, that Joe Rohde and crew did absolutely exquisite work on a very thin plot.
Mm-hmm.
You could not have asked them to do any better. In fact, I sent Joe a note actually saying that. And in many ways, I think, Jim, this is the end of Imagineering, like 20th century Imagineering. This is the culmination of everything that they could possibly do with the tools that they had available through the early part of the 21st century. This is it. Every trick that they know, every piece of technology that had existed when they started, they put it in this land and it seems to work. And I think this is the apex of, like I said, 20th century Imaginary. It doesn't get better than this in terms of filming a place. The challenge that they're going to face is exactly what you said about Star Wars Land. In Star Wars Land, we know, for example, that there's going to be technology that not only makes this interactive, which is something that isn't really in Pandora right now, but that remembers you over time.
Yeah.
And going forward,
the
standard for Imagineering and for Star Wars Land is going to be, yes, Pandora is the base of what an immersive environment is like. But to that, you have to add personalization and memory. And that's the challenge. So, you know, for me, I think it's better than Diagon Alley. Is it enough to sit back for 10 years and coast? And I'm not saying Universal coasted, but is it enough for Disney to market this for 10 years like Universal did for Harry Potter? No. I mean, they've got to essentially say, we're done with this, and now we have to up it in 2 years. Mm-hmm. 2 years from now, we have to do all of this that's just took 7 years, and we have to add memory and interactivity and personalities.
Okay.
And I think that's a monster challenge for Disney. You know,
no, I agree.
I think they can do it. I mean, this is a very promising first step. Okay. I think really Pandora is essentially the world's greatest three-dimensional movie trailer for the films that are about to come up. I mean that in the very nicest way.
Well,
I
no, think and I will tell you flat out, John Landau, the producer of the Avatar film, feels the exact same way, Len.
Yeah. All right, so Jim, next time we'll talk about gift shops and food on the next show. How's that?
That works for me.
All right, folks, you've been listening to the Disney Dish podcast with Jim Hill. Please go onto iTunes and Stitcher and rate our show and tell us what you would like to hear next. For Jim, this is Len. We will see you on the next show.
Take care.